Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In 1983, Huey Lewis and the News released their third album, Sports. Sports spawned four top 10 hit singles and another that cracked the top 20, iconic music videos, and sold almost 10 million copies. To celebrate the 30th anniversary of the record, Huey Lewis and the News will tour the US and the UK beginning this Friday, and will release a special commemorative edition of the album, digitally remastered and containing a live concert version of each of the 9 songs on the album. In case you aren't familiar with the record, or just haven't spent time with it in a while, here's a crash, or refresher, course on Sports. That was The Heart of Rock and Roll, Heart and Soul, Bad is Bad, I Want a New Drug, Walking on a Thin Line, Finally Found a Home, If This Is It, You Crack Me Up, and Honky Tonk Blues, in the order that they appear on Sports. Honky Tonk Blues is, of course, a Hank Williams song. Huey Lewis and the News will be playing on this coast this weekend and early next week, and it is a huge thrill for me to welcome Huey Lewis to the Roundtable.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Congratulations on the 30th anniversary of Sports.
Thank you.
Why a 30th anniversary special edition and tour and not the 25th?
It's a pretty good question, I guess. Maybe because we didn't think of it in the 25th. I mean, we are in show business, so we probably should have. But, yeah, we did think of the 30th, and we're gonna take that horse and beat it pretty good.
Were you involved at all in the tracks selected for the bonus album for the special edition?
Yeah. The idea was to do the Sports album reissued, remastered, and then to do a live version of such in exact same song, same order, but each one culled from a live performance in the 80s. For example, the New Drug is from Australia, and Bad is from Boston, and Harder Rock and Roll from Cleveland, that kind of thing. The only trouble with it, in theory, it was a great idea, but we had two of the tracks, the last two in the record, we never recorded. We barely played them live and never recorded them. So we recorded them live at our new little recording facility, Trout Farm, we call it.
Where is the recording facility?
In San Rafael. It's our office and our full place. It's our rehearsal studio and our recording facility. Three in one.
Do you have anything special planned for the tour? Obviously, there might be surprises you don't want to tell us about, but anything, any old band members coming back for any of the dates?
Or? Maybe. That's a possibility. There's a lot of stuff that could happen. There's some things that will happen. We are going to play the record from front to back, first of all. Mind you, that's only 44 minutes, you know, or thereabouts, so there'll be more than that. And in most markets, and I don't know, in a lot of markets, we're promoting it with, if you're 30 years old, if you're born in 83, get in free. It informs the show a little bit, so that it invites a look back 30 years ago when we made the sports record at essentially 30 years old. We were all sort of 30 years old. And what's happened between then and now, musically, technologically, et cetera, culturally, it's pretty amazing period, really.
I was born in 1983. But
you were?
I was, but I bought tickets just in case those ones are gone when I get there, because the nearest date to me is in New York, so I'm going down to New York to see you guys, and I cannot wait.
Well, you could have got in free.
Well, that's okay. I don't mind.
But it is interesting to note, you know, 30 years ago when you were born, we were about 30, and this is a collection of songs from that time. And going back over it, it really, really became clear to me that, you know, that time, say 1983, radio was king. MTV had just started, but MTV was playing the videos for 80, 81, 82, 83 that were the hits, if you know what I mean. It was radio-driven, all of that.
Of course.
And so our object, producing a record ourselves, which was pretty rare in those days for an unknown band, was to get a hit record. And that was, you know, and so that's it. It now sounds like a kind of a collection of singles to me, the album Sports, because I realized we were, in fact, aiming for radio. There was no internet. FM radio was already programmed, just like AM radio. And that was the one sort of avenue to success.
Speaking of the 80s videos, I was rewatching them. I hadn't seen them in a while, and I was rewatching them last night. And I, you know, mightn't ask you about them because they are 30 years old nearly, except that's what we're talking about today. They looked like they had extensive shoots. Who came up with the concepts for the albums, and how long were you guys working on them?
Usually a day, usually one whole day, but sometimes two whole days. We made videos on when we first formed an outfit in San Francisco called Video West asked us, did we want to make a video? If we allowed them to make a video, the video cameras were brand new. This is like 1978, or 77, 78. If we would allow them to shoot a video, they would show it once or twice, and then we could have it. I said, sure. And on this outfit called Video West. So we did it for $800. We did So My Loves Are True and Don't Ever Tell Me You Love Me. Those videos are what sort of got assigned to the record label, because the record label saw that and thought they were kind of good. You know, they were sort of a marketing approach for us. We goofed around down at Ocean Beach on Some My Lies Are True, and the Mountain Amphitheater in Mount Tamalpais on Don't Ever Tell Me She Loved Me. The idea being to juxtapose, you know, where would you least likely to see a rock band, and then do a video there. Our first single came out, Do You Believe in Love? The record label really wanted to do a video, because now MTV was off and running. And they wanted to get a real professional guy to do it. And so even though by now we were producing the records ourselves, they wanted to get a professional guy to do the video, which was fine with us. And they hired an ad guy who matched the set to our clothes and the kind of pastel colors, roughly one complementing the other. We had a lot of makeup on. This is the video where we were in the bed, all in one bed, singing to the girl. And so anyway, it was one long day, and we do the video. And now there's a playback 2 weeks later at the record company. And we show up, and there must be 30 people in the room. There's, you know, the production people from the video and the record company people and us. And they show the thing, and I think it's horrible. I think it's cringeworthy. I'm dying watching this thing. And at the end, everybody stood up and gave it a standing ovation. And I thought to myself, well, anybody can do this. So for them, I said, well, we're producing our records ourselves. Why don't we do these videos ourselves? So from then on, we insisted on sort of conceiving and co-directing all of our videos. And the notion was just to have fun, goof, shoot them outside in San Francisco and let the seagulls chew the scenery and be our production for us, and just avoid a literal translation of the song if at all possible, and goof around.
Yeah, it does look like you guys are having a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was actually kind of fun. I mean, we had some big laughs. I remember some of those things we staged them. Some of them were very, very funny laughs.
So because you're doing this release, as you said a few minutes ago, you're going to beat the 30th anniversary drum loudly and capitalize on it, I guess, if you can. Mm-hmm. You recently did a Funny or Die video parodying the semi-iconic scene from American Psycho. How did that come about, and how was it working with the guys over at Funny or Die?
It was wonderful. They were fantastic. First of all, it was their idea, mm-hmm. and then and they just came to me with it, and it was just a fabulous idea, I thought.
Yeah.
And we had a ball doing it. And although I must say, there was probably a lot of them. It's quite a production doing that. I mean, were there 12 people there? Maybe all mostly in their 20s. These kids,
right?
Smart as can be. And serious as all get out. Very, very serious. Comedy, apparently, is very serious work.
Well, it's a lot of work, yeah.
Yeah. Funny.
Was it also their idea to have Weird Al be the person you murder?
Yeah, that was their idea as well. And Weird Al's a good guy and did a great job. He's a fun guy.
You live in Montana, where wildlife and conservation is a big deal, and it's a big deal for you. How did you discover your love of the outdoors?
Well, my dad always did, and always took me hiking and camping and abalone diving and trout fishing and pheasant hunting, all that kind of stuff. So I grew up from an early age, and I grew up in Northern California, which was a wildlife paradise until 1967, 68, 69. But I'm a fly fisherman first and foremost, so mm-hmm. I've come to Montana many times to fly, or not many, a few times to fly fish, and that was always my dream, to get a little piece of ground and treat it right, you know.
What do you love about fly fishing? Why is it something you've stuck with your whole life?
Well, it's outdoors, it's mm-hmm. peaceful, you know, nobody bothers you. For a guy most of my gigs are in big cities and populations, it's sort of the opposite of that. It's really, it's very relaxing, and it's challenging, it's endlessly challenging.
I saw in a thing on USA Today recently, they were discussing your math aptitude, which I had already heard about, but you said even though you had sort of a natural math prowess, it wasn't something you ever really wanted to pursue, and you always wanted to be a musician or a poet. Do you write poetry?
I did, and I still write a little bit. I flirt with the idea of writing a book one day, but it's just so time-consuming is the problem. I don't have the time anymore yet. You know, I just don't. I think maybe one day I could write something.
A book of poetry or a novel?
No, I'd probably write a novel. I'd probably write a novel. But I did write a little poetry in school, oddly enough. First of all, my poetry teacher was a guy called Jim Waugh, who was also my baseball coach. And he was an amazing guy and a really big influence on me. Probably my second, my sort of second father figure in my life. And he was just a very cool guy. And I think the broad message, maybe the specific message, was how cool poetry is. But I think the broader message was, you can be anything you want to be in this world. You know, you really, really can. And he was sort of the living proof of that. So I decided, harmonica, why not? we'll see if he's right or not. If we can make a living playing harmonica, you really can't do anything.
So he was right.
He was right.
Do you... When you're just hanging out at home, do you pull out the harmonica, or is it associated with work for you?
Yeah, it is kind of associated with work, but I do have one always around, and I do play it occasionally, I must admit. And you know what I really do is I take it on trips when I go, if I go on a fishing trip, for example. I go to British Columbia every year and go steelhead fishing, and I always bring a harmonica there. And I tend to play kind of more on the road, and I kind of went away from my job, as it were. Because
uh-huh.
on the gig, I don't play that much harmonica because I have this great band and all these great soloists, and of course, I'm always keen to give them solos and so on, so I don't play as much as I used to.
Speaking of the band, how much are you in touch with your bandmates when you're not touring or recording? Are you guys pals? Do you send Christmas cards, or is that also sort of a work relationship?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a pretty good question, and I think it's not, people say, are you still friends? And, friends really doesn't get it. I mean, mm-hmm. we've been, this is our 35th year almost, So we're really more like brothers, if you know what I mean. It's
sure.
It's worse than that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, friends treat each other pretty well all the time. You know, brothers do and don't. And I think that's more like what we're at, what we are.
There has been comparatively little turnover in the band. You know, not a lot of different drummers or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
We pay well.
That's very straightforward.
No, we're it's a fun gig. There's no, you know, it's really a band deal with us. So that, and we try and make the best of everything. But we have had some turnover. There's four of us, our original members, and it's just that the new members are 20 years and that sort of stuff. And we have a 3-piece horn section with us now, been almost 20 years. But some of the guys, some of our horn players are also have other interests. They play jazz or they have their own solo thing going. So they're allowed to sub out on a gig and still maintain their chair. So I try and make it a kind of an easy gig for people. If they really want to pursue something that's important to them, so as long as they sub properly, they keep the chair and they don't lose the gig. So they like that. They think that's good. Kind of a Broadway approach to things.
Sure. I read also that you have a pension and benefits. Is that common?
That's right.
Is that common at all for a band to provide that?
I don't know. It seemed like the right thing for us to do because we've been together so much, you know, mm-hmm. so many of us been together so much. So yeah. But and it's helped out. We've had a couple of our organization have had serious health issues. We lost our tenor player to multiple myeloma, and you know, our sound longtime sound guy, you know, since forever, and just like a member of the band, Jim Moran's got colon cancer and he's fighting right now. So it's a good thing we do these benefit things.
Absolutely.
Healthcare is important, folks.
Right. Right. Do you consume, do you listen to much new music?
Well, I'm all over the place. You know, I mainly listen to stuff that people send me that are pals of mine. I mean, there's a jam band called Umphreys McGee that I like a lot. They're real fun. Listen to them. Bruce Hornsby's a friend of mine. I listen to his stuff when he sends it to me. But when I go to commercial stuff, I listen to old jazz, oddly enough. Louis Armstrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's an album called Satch Plays Fats.
Yeah.
That I've rediscovered. It was like one of the first records my dad used to play in 1955 when it came out when I was 5 years old. I remember it. Wow. You know, that kind of stuff. So I like a lot of jazz, big band stuff for some reason.
Because it's good.
Yeah, really. Well, you don't see a lot of it anymore.
Right.
I mean, it's something about a band. You know, I've always been a band guy. I like band music as opposed to individual virtuosity, if you will. I like it when the band's real blowing.
Mr. Lewis, I have taken up enough of your time for today. I thank you so much for calling in.
I appreciate it. Didn't hurt a bit.
Great. And I can't wait to see the show in New York.
Excellent. Yeah, we're Irving Plaza, I assume, right?
That's right.
Excellent. See you there.
The Sports 30th Anniversary Tour kicks off this Friday night. The special commemorative edition of the album will be released next Tuesday, May 14th. To learn more, visit HueyLewisAndTheNews.com. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. This is it.